teens. Lying about sex in order to shape their reputations and the reputations of others rather than actually getting knocked up and spreading social diseases like folks used to in the good old days. I gotta wonder about these kids today. When will they learn? Probably sometime in their 20s, I'd guess. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, senior editor at Creative Screenwriting Magazine, and today I'm very pleased to have screenwriter Bert V. Royal stop in to talk about his first film that's been produced, the very funny Easy A. For those of you who really dig this podcast, it's now in its fifth year, if you could believe it, ever since I began with that first episode of The Island back in August of 2005 with Kurtzman and Orsi. And I gotta say, while time does fly, one thing kind of remains the same. I'm constantly finding myself in need of new equipment, software, hard drives, batteries, recorders, cables, connectors, flashcards, etc. All to keep this kooky thing going, and I can't do it alone. So it would be greatly appreciated if you would toss in a tip so that I could continue to have access to the much-needed supplies, and you could do so over at creativescreenwritingmagazine.blogspot.com. Just click on the PayPal link in the top right corner of the screen, and really anything you're in the mood to give is ultra helpful if enough of you do it, and will hopefully keep me out of debt. Of course, not giving anything as you continue to listen to this free podcast is not so helpful. So thanks again for visiting creativescreenwritingmagazine.blogspot.com and clicking on the PayPal link in the top right corner. In other good news, I'm also quite pleased that I finally have a normal link to give you so that you could purchase a digital issue or digital subscription to Creative Screenwriting Magazine. That's right, if you want to read us digitally on any home computer, laptop, or even your iPad, just go to www.creativescreenwriting.com/digital. And you'll currently be able to find the September-October 2010 issue. It features a Terry Winter interview for his new HBO series, Boardwalk Empire. Screenwriter Aaron Sorkin tells us all about The Social Network. Chris Sparling tells us all about Buried and the Hober Brothers, all about Red. In every issue, you'll also find plenty of other excellent articles, interviews, and columns to boot. So if you dig this podcast, especially now that we've gone digital, you've really got no excuse but to have right in front of you the latest issue of Creative Screenwriting Magazine. As time goes by on that same page, you'll also be able to find back issues for sale as well. If you'd like to save yourself some cash, you could still use discount coupon code CSPODCAST to save 10% off the already low subscription rate, and now your print subscription currently includes a free digital subscription as well. So kids, be it a single issue or a full subscription, you could find it all at www.creativescreenwriting.com/digital. Of course, you could still go old school and buy the print edition on newsstands at Barnes & Noble and Borders Bookshops, the United States, Canada, the UK, Western Europe, and of course, Australia. Now, should you be the kind of person that wants to follow my exploits online and get the inside info on when I announce screenings, etc., you could follow me as Yo Goldsmith on Twitter. Or look for my fan page on Facebook, which is a great place to communicate not only with me, but with other podcast listeners from around the world as well, so check that out. And if you're still looking for cool things to do online, don't forget to catch this week's Film Spotting podcast with hosts Adam Kempinar and Maddie Robinson at filmspotting.net. Over there, you'll find film reviews, interviews, and a lot of the cinematic chatter that will keep you coming back for more. So head on over to filmspotting.net. Finally, and very important, if you're interested in attending the largest screenwriting conference in North America, it's kind of like Comic-Con, but with screenwriting and screenwriters and screenwriting teachers and whatnot. Now in its ninth year, the Screenwriting Expo will be in Los Angeles on the weekend of October 9th, 2010. It's a huge event wherein you could take classes geared for all levels of writers, pitch to actual Hollywood executives and representatives from the studios, agencies, and management companies as well. You could check out all the details about this event continually being updated by visiting www.screenwritingexpo.com. It really is a great event to get your creative juices flowing, and it allows for writers from all over the world to meet and geek out for one big weekend on everything associated with screenwriting. As a podcast listener, you could again use podcast discount coupon code CSPODCAST to save 10% off a regular or a gold pass to the Screenwriting Expo. So, I really hope you read up on the event at www.screenwritingexpo.com, and I look forward to seeing you there. But now, without further ado, let's jump right into the Q&A of this sold-out screening after I introduced screenwriter Bert V. Royal to discuss his latest film, Easy A. As is our tradition, here's your very own issue of Creative Screenwriting Magazine. You are page 76, sir.
Awesome.
Give it up
Thank
for 76.
You. Yeah. My new best friend, Janelle Riley.
Janelle Riley wrote the article. We're going to talk about some of the things she wrote about. So we always like to start with breaking in stories. Okay. To my knowledge, what put you on the path, your first industry job was working as a casting assistant on Third Watch.
Yes.
What did you learn in that capacity? I'm guessing at that point in time, you thought you wanted to eventually end up as a casting agent.
No, I did. I did. That's actually why I moved to New York. When I went to college, I was the least talented person in the entire school.
And where'd you go to school?
And they told me that at my audition. I'm not kidding. I went to a little school called Florida School of the Arts in Palatka, Florida, and I did a little shout out to Palatka, Florida. But originally my line was Palatka. They sent him to live in Palatka, Florida, which I think is Tumuquan Indian for smells like ass.
So you harbor no ill will to them.
I went to college, and I was terrible. I was a musical theater student because I'm a huge musical theater freak. And I just wasn't very good. I couldn't sing, I couldn't dance, and I really couldn't act. But I loved the arts, and so I asked them, I said, can I just stay here, please? I'll just do something. And they're like, okay, well, you know what? You can be a student. We'll put you in the musical theater department. Just please don't sing in front of us. And, see if you can find your way. So they sort of let me sit in on a lot of the process, and the casting process to me was so exciting. I felt like I knew talent. Like I was really good at that. Like I would say, I want to be friends with her because she's really good. And so I ended up dropping out of school and moving to New York when I was 20. And I worked at some great casting offices. Started mostly in theater. I worked at the New York Shakespeare Festival, which was awesome. So that was a really long answer.
You were also you worked in casting on the Chappelle Show.
I did. Now, the first season.
I absolutely love that show. What was your wildest or most surreal day, or did you kind of realize how great it was going to be while you were working there?
But I've actually never seen the show.
Really?
Yeah, but I sat in on the auditions, which was amazing. There was this the first sketch that I did in the office was the white supremacist sketch where it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
He's a blind white supremacist.
Even
though he's African American.
Yeah,
it's great.
Who has no idea. And it was so funny. This guy came in to audition, and it's just a very nebbishy guy. And he came in for one of the white supremacist roles. And he said, "Do you mind if I ad lib?" And I'm sitting there with the casting associate, Eli, and he starts ad-libbing all these like really horrible racist things. This like nebbishy guy, and it was so funny. We were trying so hard not to laugh, and I actually think he ended up getting cast as a small part in that sketch. That was wild, though. We would get the scripts and we'd be like, "There's no way in hell that they're gonna film this," and they did all of it. Like I remember reading, I think the last one I read before I left that office was I think it got filmed with the one where Dave Chappelle was like Godzilla and he peed or something. And I'm reading this, I'm like, "They're
oh, that
never
was on television, my friend."
Yeah. I was like, "They're never gonna film this. So why do we have to do this?" And of course, they did it.
So golden Godzilla showers on the page didn't work for you.
I just didn't think it was going to happen. I thought it was really funny, but I was like, "There's no way." But yeah, that was really cool about Comedy Central. They really let him go there.
It's tough for a lot of young writers to really give up the day job and to make a more honest or time consuming commitment to writing. I know that you gravitated into theater next.
Yes.
Was there a day where you put the day job aside, or were you still doing that kind of on the side at nights in your off hours when you were writing your plays?
That's a good question. I did want to be a writer. I've always wanted to be a writer. But I wrote this play called George Glass, which actually there was a bit of a shout out in Easy A to that. But I wrote this play, and I just thought it was the greatest play ever written. I was so excited about it. It was a gay play, and it was about this guy who is abused by his imaginary boyfriend. And I thought it was the best thing ever written. And I showed it to some friends, and they're like, Yeah. And they, like, I literally, they were changing their numbers so they didn't have to tell me how bad this play was. So, you know, and I took a hint eventually. So I kind of put it aside and I was writing this musical. And again,
so wait, it's like the king of comedy for a gay guy being abused by imaginary boyfriend.
Yeah, it was awful. I mean, it was really bad. And, you know, it's so funny. I wish I could read it now, but I think it's long deleted from my hard drive.
Had you quit at that point?
Writing?
No, from like being in
no,
casting.
No. This was like nighttime stuff, you know, just on the side. And then what happened was I was working at Third Watch, and I don't think that my bosses liked me very much. So they called me into their office one day and they were like, do you like working here? And I was like, and they're like, well, we don't really like you. So, so maybe we should just call it a day. And I'm like, yes, that's awesome. So I think I got fired or quit. I'm not exactly sure. And I called my dad, and I was just burnt out at this point because I was working in clubs at night. And then coming into work. That's probably why they didn't like me. I was asleep for half the day. And I was just tired. And I really just wanted to watch television.
Model employee.
Exactly. And I called my dad up and I was like, Dad, can you support me for like 3 months? Or I think I said 6 months. And he said, how about this? I'll pay your rent for 3 months, but what are you going to do while I pay this rent? And I said, well, I'm going to write a play. Or a book or something, a magazine, I don't know. And he said, okay, you know what, I'll pay your rent for 3 months. And I had like tiny rent. And so I watched daytime television for 2.5 months. And my dad calls me up and he said, I can't wait to read that thing you're writing. And I said, I can't wait for you to read it. And so I sat down, I was like, I have to write something quickly. And I was dating this guy at the time, and we had been on the subway, and I think it was Christmas time, and I was thinking about Charlie Brown or something, and I said, you know, it'd be a really great play, Charlie Brown in high school, but it's all like messed up high school. And he said, that's the worst idea I've ever heard in my entire life. And he broke up with me the next day. And so I was like, I'm going to show you. And so I wrote this play called Dog Sees God. Oh my God, you've heard of it.
It won an overall excellence award at the 2004 Fringe Fest in New York.
It did. I mean, you know, again, it was just this funny sort of like week of my life where I was depressed and drinking heavily. And I may have partaken in some other things too, but at the end of the week, I had this play, and I gave it to my friend, my best friend Sorrel Tomlinson, to read, and she read it, and she was like, "I'm going to produce this," and I was like, "Okay," and she did. She produced it, and you know, we won the Fringe Festival, and then it just kind of spiraled into this huge, huge thing. So
yeah, one other awards. I mean, in Janelle's article in the current issue of Creative Screenwriting, she described it as, quote, a parody homage of Charles M. Schulz's beloved Peanuts gang. But in Royal's world, the gang was in high school and grappling with such issues as homosexuality and major drug use. So did the Schulz family give a reaction to this play?
You know, they didn't. And the thing about it is it's, you know, parody law, so... gray. I mean, it really is. And I'm pleased that, you know, that they, I shouldn't say they gave me the opportunity because they never signed off on anything.
Yeah.
But, we never heard anything from them, but you know, it's parody and I would have fought.
And you probably would have won. Actually.
Well, and maybe, you know, that's the thing. You never know. You really never know. But I did a lot of research on parody law. And, you know, The Wind Done Gone was like, you know, this sort of landmark parody case, which I was reading all about. I know everything about that book, except I've never read it. Yeah, no idea.
Well, it got you an agent and a manager, to my knowledge. And
it did.
That kind of led to Hollywood overtures. Talk about kind of that stage.
Yeah, it was so bizarre. So the night of the first reading, you know, we had assembled quite a cool little cast of people. I think Jennifer Esposito was in it, Alexander Chaplin, like some Spin City people. Camp had just come out, so Daniel Letterly was in it, and we had a great cast. And the packed house, and there's this woman there who was soaked to the bone because it was raining outside and she didn't have her own umbrella. And she approached me after the play and she said, you know, I want to represent you. I was like, okay. And that's how I kind of just did everything in my first year. Okay. and then she set me up with Paradigm, and I've been with this amazing representation ever since, since pretty much day one, you know.
That's
cool.
That's great. I forgot to ask earlier, what did your dad think of it when he read it?
You know, it's so funny. My dad didn't read it. I gave it to my mom, though, and she called me crying the next day, and she goes, was your life like that bad? And I said, Mom, it's fiction.
Well, so what was your... You started doing assignment writing for studios.
Yes, I did. I got
You were Treasure's Trove, to my knowledge, and Parents on Strike was what Janelle reported.
Right. Parents on Strike was my first thing, which was...
Give us the pitch.
Oh, I can't. I'm a horrible pitcher. And I'll never forget, like, I was sitting in the room at the conference table, my first pitch. First pitch in L.A., and I almost threw up all over the table. And I still, to this day, almost threw up on every table. And I think I talked for an hour and 20 minutes, which pitches are not supposed to be that long, I've learned. It was longer than the actual movie was going to be. It was actually an amazing process. I mean, I had a great set of producers who knew that it was my first screenplay, so they, you know, they hovered over me, you know, making sure that I was doing everything right. But it actually worked for me. I needed it. And we worked on it for a long, 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 long time before it finally got taken out of my hands and given to somebody else, and I don't know whatever happened to it.
How many years ago? Was that like 2005?
God, yeah. Okay. Probably around 2005.
And 2006. What about Treasure's Trove?
Treasure's Trove. That was a really fun
one. You did
one.
Something, I guess, that was kind of like the film adaptation, the way that Charlie Kaufman...
Yeah.
Explain what you did.
Exactly. It was really weird. You know, a Treasure's Trove is this really cool little children's book that came out a few years ago. And what sort of drew attention to it was that Michael Stather, the guy that wrote it, hid these jewels all over the country. And there were clues inside the book, and families were going on these treasure hunts together. And it was amazing. It was really cool. And but the story itself was about fairies and elves, and you know, Lord of the Rings had just come out, so no one cared about that. So they said, you know, we want to do this as like a, you know, about people trying to find the treasures, which I thought, oh, well, that's really, really cool. So they said, and you know, and Michael Stather will be our main character. And I, you know, it was so bizarre because I had no idea who this guy was at all. And to try to write, and they're like, and possibly Tom Cruise will play him. And I had no idea. So I said, you know, I have to meet Michael. And they're like, no, you don't really need to meet Michael. I was like, no, I have to meet him. So I actually went up to his house in upstate New York. He was such a cool guy. Gave me great ideas. But he sort of thought that we were sort of pitching the straight adaptation of it. And it was an amazing experience. But again, yeah. Script heaven.
But you put yourself in the screenplay, if I'm not mistaken, or something like that. Like the
movie. I put myself in every script.
Well, no, I mean, but did you do it like Charlie Kaufman's
no,
movie?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't me. It was him.
It was him. Okay.
Yeah, it was Michael Stather that I was sort of making
gotcha.
The character. Yeah.
And what's the status of that project?
Oh, I have no idea.
No idea.
It went away.
Now, if I recall, Easy A came together in a moment of panic after the WGA strike.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
It was about 2 weeks after the strike, and I had been sitting in my bed with a bottle of wine watching SVU all day long. My boyfriend would go to work and come home. I'd have like Chardonnay like dripping down me, and I'm like, you know, telling him about what had happened on SVU that day. They all sort of end the same. That was a really bad joke. I'm sorry. I apologize for that. And you know, he was getting worried. Everyone was sort of worried about me. But I guess I thought that right after the strike was over, my phone was going to be ringing off the hook. And it wasn't at all. And so I'll never forget this as long as I live. I started watching the Legally Blonde casting reality show. And I remembered I had DVR'd Legally Blonde, when it, the musical, on MTV. And so I like dragged myself out of bed. I looked like a creature. And like I dragged myself in and I watched Legally Blonde, the musical. And something happened to me. It's so weird to say that. Like, so I like got in a good mood and I brushed my hair. It was awesome. And and so it sort of like pulled me back to life. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to write something. I'm going to be like Elle Woods, and I'm going to write something. She didn't write anything, but she was cool. So I sat at my computer, and I sort of imagined this character named Olive Pendergast, and I had no idea what I was doing with her. And I wrote the first page. And then, you know, I get to the end, and I'm like, yeah, that's a good monologue. Get to the second page. And so I had literally no outlining, no anything for anything in this movie. So I just started writing and stopped when I finished.
How common is that in your work? I mean, do you find yourself outlining? Or once you knew that you were going to continue Easy A as a screenplay, did you break it down into an outline?
No.
Really?
No.
So you never outline?
I do when it's an assignment, because they make me. But it's so funny because I like the journey that a character makes, and I like to make that journey with the character, and I like to think the way that they'll think. So if it's all mapped out, it feels a little too easy. I like going along with it.
Do you know points in your story, like your middle and your end, for instance? Or
they never work out the way that I think that they will or should. Originally, with this script, I imagined this very, very dark, dark ending. It was going to be all fun and games until the end, when she was going to get kicked out of school. And, you know, everything was going to go wrong. And it was all about sexual politics and blah, 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 blah. And by the time I got to that point in the script, I was like, I can't write that. I really need to... It needs to be a musical number. So that's what I decided to do.
The script begins with a classical inciting incident in which, you know, basically a little white lie leads to new lies. And when did you, like, because obviously that wasn't a page one issue. When did you kind of realize that the whole movie was going to go that way? And if I remember correctly, you weren't going to just use Scarlet Letter. You were going to also use other literature and other classes that were influencing. So tell us a little more about that early stage.
That was going to be for two other projects.
It wasn't
for this. Originally, it was so funny because I think when I first signed with my agency, they were like, you know, what do you feel like writing? What do you want to do? And I had, you know, done this weird, not adaptation of Charlie Brown, but like some weird alternate reality version of it. And so I was thinking, oh, you know, it would be nice to take three really cool classical literature pieces and set them in the same high school and have characters sort of intersect throughout the stories. So the first one that I wrote, I actually wrote one, which was Cyrano, which I know has been done to death, but I really wanted to do it because I love that play. And I wrote it, and I really love it. To this day, I think it's one of the best things I've ever written, but people weren't crazy about it. Again, it was like George Glass syndrome. I was like, it's so good, and nobody likes it.
I'm sure people would be willing to look at it now, amigo.
Maybe. I hope so. It's really short, though. I think it's like 86 pages, which is a no-no. But I thought it was really cool because I kept with the original ending of Cyrano, which it usually isn't done in adaptations. They, you know, Roxanne and Cyrano, you know, bounce away into the sunset. I really kept it close to the original ending.
So Cyrano was one. What were the other two?
Cyrano, and then Easy A was just one that I had sort of told my agents, and they were like, ooh, we like the title. We like the idea. And so I think that's why I was like, oh, well, somebody once told me they liked that idea. So that's, you know, Legally Blonde moment. I sat down to write that one.
And then what was the third literature?
The third one is, and it hasn't been written yet, but I really want to do The Mystery of Edwin Drood set in high school. Like, I think that would be
That'd
fun.
Be cool.
Yeah. Just, I don't know how it's going to end.
Well, so how long?
It's a joke.
How long did you spend writing Easy A?
Well, it's funny. I don't really remember. I think I still had a few bottles of wine. There were some left over from the SVU days. I think it was probably about 5 days.
Really? 5 days?
5 days. I got all the way to the end. And then, you know, I was going to do my dark ending, and I decided to stop and take a step back. And I let a few people read it, and they really liked it. And they were like, okay, you have to finish this. You have to finish this. But there was really only like 10 pages left to be written. So I took a little bit of time until I figured out, yes, it's got to end with a pep rally. I love pep rallies. I love writing pep rallies. They're crazy. What are they? I don't even know what they are.
And you began the film with them, and
yeah,
then you ended?
It's okay. Weird, but I love writing them. So yeah, I was like, that. This is the way to end it.
So 5 days to completion or 5 days to almost completion, take a break?
5 days, like a week or two break, and then I finished the last 10 pages in like an hour. I was so excited. I was like, I know what I'm doing.
How long was that first draft?
The first draft was long. It was the longest script I've ever written. It was like 115 pages.
Okay. That's about average, but that's good.
115 pages.
When you write, how many hours a day do you write for?
You know, I'm not the disciplined writer that
I know, but completing like nearly 105 pages in 5 days is pretty amazing.
I have to have it. Like if it's an assignment, I have to really be ready. Like I can sit down and write these characters, and once I do it, you know, I can sit down for 4 or 5 hours at a time and just write. My boyfriend, he's so great. He's funnier than I am, way funnier. So, you know, it's consistently, like, he'll be playing video games on the couch, and I'll be like, is this funny? And he's like, try this. It's really cute. Like, I'm at the dining room table, and, you know, we get to spend quality time together, but sometimes he tries to talk to me. He's like, oh, my God, Elizabeth Hasselbeck said the funniest thing on The View this morning. And I'm like, shh, I'm writing. What was the question again? Yeah,
I'm not sure it matters at this point.
Sorry.
All right. Well, so
a few hours a day, if I'm lucky.
All right. Well, so you got this draft done. Now, I've interviewed people that have written really fast drafts in the past.
Yes.
And what usually occurs is that they consider it like they're fast, get it out of my system, pass.
Right.
And then they kind of go back for a stage of refinement. Did that occur with you? Or?
Absolutely. I think everything has to start with a vomit draft, and it never.
That's what Judd Apatow calls it, actually.
Yeah, that's what I've always heard it to be called. And it all starts there, and then you know I have this really great council of friends who read my stuff. And
are they writers? Or are they just
no.
Are they non-industry people?
I mean, my mom wants to be a writer. you know, it's like my mom, my boyfriend, my best friend Sorrel, my two best friends Karen and Rochelle, who are writers. You know, they read it, and my agents, my manager, and then, you know, they give me notes, and they say, you know, we like this, and their notes are usually pretty consistent. I mean, they usually, you know, it's blaringly obvious which parts of my script suck. So
do you do it comparatively in which when people that don't know each other have the same note, you kind of think to yourself, I've got to take that note?
Yeah, exactly.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, how long was that stage? How long was your rewrite?
Like a day, 2 days.
Come on, one day, really?
No, I mean,
it's great.
When you know what you're gonna do, and you sit down to do it, it's. I think it's a lot easier. I mean, sometimes it's hard to wrap your head around it, like, you know. But once you understand the note, I'm not a just get in there and try something. I want to know that. You know, I don't like to work. I like to, like, watch TV. And so,
okay, after
it's work.
After the revision and you were happy with it, mm-hmm. Then how long after you had written it did it go out for sale?
Oh, right away. I mean, you know, my agents, it was just amazing. Like, the whole thing traveled at the speed of light. I mean, I had never been through something like that. I didn't even know what a spec script was, really. They had to explain it to me. They're like, you wrote one. they called me the next day, and they said, you know, here are the territories, blah, blah, blah. And they're like spouting off a lot of things that I don't understand. I call my manager afterwards. I'm like, what does this mean? And she said, well, it's out there. So
do you know how many places they got it out to when it went out
for
sale?
It went out to quite a few places. But, you know, Screen Gems came in pretty early, and they said, you know, we want to do this, but we want to actually make it. And that was kind of exciting to me. It wasn't just like a purchase. It was like they kind of promised it, but not. I mean, you know, they didn't say, we promise we'll make it. But I felt that they were going to, and they did very quickly, too.
a lot of first-time writers, and I know at this point you're not a first-time writer because you've done assignments, but a first spec sale, sometimes it's like a dangerous territory to travel, and you run the risk of a spec being trapped in development hell and not being able to get it out of it.
Sure.
Did you have protections, like a progress to production part of your deal or stuff like that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Again, like when they tell me, they try to explain things to me, but I'm not very intelligent. So I'm just seeing dollar signs like floating above my head.
All right. Well, so they paid the right price for it. Well, so after it sold, how long was that considering when you started the screenplay? Give us the period.
Let's see. When the strike ended in
March of 07 of 08, sorry.
Yeah, so I think it went out in May, like beginning of May, and sold within like a couple of days.
That's really fast.
Yeah, it was.
I think more screenwriters need to watch SVU.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's what's going on. Was there anything major that you learned like on this first sale?
Oh, sure. I've learned a ton of stuff. But all good stuff. I mean, it was sort of this charmed dream experience, and I people sort of hate me for that because everyone says, "Oh, your first movie, it's gonna be an awful, awful experience, and you're gonna hate it." And I've seen this movie like 22 times. I love it. I mean, and not because I wrote it, but just because I thought everyone did an amazing job.
It's a funny movie. The crowd loved it tonight.
Yeah, it was just a lot of fun. And so everything just kind of happened so easily. And everyone was really, really nice and supportive. And, you know, they really did what they said they were going to do.
You have a very organic way of writing, obviously, as you explained. And I'm not trying to overanalyze it, but it's just interesting because this film is so structured. So the structure of the webcam, coming back to those monologues, it seemed like five times if I was
probably
keeping track. I mean, when did you realize you were going to do that as a device? Was it after the first page that you wrote it on the first page?
The first page was definitely a webcam. And the monologue has pretty much stayed intact. Well, no, it was a little different. It was a little more accessible. I think Olive really started out as a smarty pants from, you know, page one, so we kind of dialed her back a bit. But the structure that I had originally written was sort of all over the place because it was a girl telling a story. And, you know, when we tell stories, we constantly have to say, oh, wait, I forgot to tell you this part. So there was a lot of jumping around in time and things. And actually, it was kind of confusing to a lot of producers and studio heads. They were like, I'm lost, you know. Will Gluck, the director, he came in and he said, okay, we're going to sort of clean this up a little bit. So the structure got a little stronger. But there were like surprises. Like originally, in the original script, in the makeout scene with young Olive, you know, the 7 minutes in heaven, she's in the closet, this dark closet, with a kid, but we don't know who the kid is. And throughout the movie, it could be one of two people. It's either Brandon, the gay kid, or Woodchuck Todd, but it leads you to believe that it was actually Brandon that she was in the closet with. And we find out at the end it was actually... So that got changed. And some of the way the Griffith characters were originally a little different... their placement within it, but we definitely made it more linear. So,
were there any other changes that Will brought on directorially that were kind of major for character moments or anything like that?
Some small, like subtle things. Like Olive originally had a little sister, and he decided to make him an adopted brother, which I thought was great. And, you know, the very tiny little subtle things. The biggest change that happened from the sale to the screen was the language and dialing it back for the audience that we were actually promoting it to.
Explain what you mean when you say dialing it back.
There were 47 F-words.
Oh, okay.
And three
for the rating,
C-words.
You mean?
Yes.
What were the other words?
Three C-words.
Ah.
And a whole lot of S's.
Nice.
So we definitely had to bring that back. And, you know...
Was that contractual?
No. But...
Because it's released as PG-13. Bought it, was it going to be R-rated?
Oh, yeah. It was going to be R-rated. And... you know, Clint said pretty early on, Clint Culpepper, the president, he said, I think this needs to be PG-13. And, you know, I grumbled and groaned at first. But I'm so glad we did it PG-13. And we actually shot it both ways. There is an R-rated version out there with 47 F-words. Maybe a few ad-libbed by the actors. But they definitely made the smartest decision. I like this version much better. I saw both.
I thought it was genius to take the Scarlet Letter concept and apply it to high school in the sense that you were dealing with the religious campus Bible group as kind of the people that were punishing her the most. Were there ever more adults involved in that, or was it always mostly the kids? Because you did keep it mostly the kids.
Yes. It was mostly the kids. It's funny because I'm very, very, very religious, and people don't believe that, but it's actually very true. And I never set out to like condemn any religion, because I'm very religious myself. But there is something sort of funny about, you know, zealots. And, I think that a lot of religion found its way in into the movie, but it wasn't by my hand.
How so?
Well, you know, I definitely wrote the scene with Olive going to the confessional booth, and she, you know, I just didn't want to make it a very religious thing. I thought like the abstinence club was more, it wasn't like a Christian society. It was just a bunch of abstinent kids, which I was an abstinent kid. I mean, I was a very late bloomer in that department. I really wasn't setting out to make fun of them or condemn them in any way whatsoever. So let the record state that.
All right. It's interesting that you have the different geeks coming up to her with requests. Were there any requests for PG-13 that were too crazy that needed to be thrown out, or a whole other group of guys that we kind of don't know about? It's always interesting to hear the early iterations.
I'm trying to think of that. You know what? Actually, that part stayed pretty similar, I think, to how it was originally.
When did the gift card idea come in rather than cash?
I don't know, but I thought that was really funny. Like when I was writing and I was like, a Target gift card. I kind of borrowed from a joke about, you know, a vibrator and a pair of flip-flops. And I substituted the pair of flip-flops for a gift card, and I thought it was really funny. So I was like, hey, wouldn't it be hysterical if she's, like, doing all this for gift cards? Because there's something funny about not taking money, but taking, like, money equivalent.
And then finally coupons.
Right. Coupons, exactly.
I love the homage to John Hughes movies in there. I thought it worked really well. And, you know, it kind of brings up what I wanted to talk about next, in which John Hughes had just an incredible ear for dialogue, and he had a great way of really making it seem, eventually through the different iterations of his drafts and working with his actors, that it really was capturing the voice of a generation. Because the danger always is that it's going to feel like a 30-year-old or 40-year-old guy talking through a teenager's mouth. What kind of challenges did you have in that category? And your dialogue was absolutely sparkling, and it was hilarious. It got great laughs, but I'm sure it's a very, very, very fine line to kind of walk across.
Well, it's funny. I think the dialogue in this movie is more like an adult speaks, because I mean, I think that's actually the way kids speak. When adults try to get too much into kids' slang, it just kind of sounds stupid. I mean, if I tried to write Yo Homes, which I still say, and nobody says it anymore, it would sound stupid. I think don't talk down to teenagers. I mean, they're just like us. That's what they say. They're just meaner. I think, you know, I kind of wrote it like I talk, but I'm immature.
Did your dialogue change a lot after it was bought, or after Will came on to direct it, or even working with the actors?
Will definitely has a style. If you've seen Fired Up, it's very quick. It's very, like, a lot of banter, and it's really, really funny. I mean, he has this weird thing that he does where he makes up words to get past the ratings board. Like, you know, so there are things that,
like, on the scene with Brandon where they're talking about all the strange
a lemon squeeze and a melon bag, and I read his like version of that. I was like, okay, you have to explain this to me. I don't think I get it. And he's like, you're not supposed to get it. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So were there other revisions with the actors when they came on board? Did you get to work with them at all?
I mean, I got to watch, which was fantastic. You know, there was some fun ad-libbing. Like, I remember in the original script, the scene where Lisa Kudrow's character is sort of explaining everything to Olive about her indiscretion. It was originally written as this, like, voiceover that Olive talks while she's sort of throwing her hands in the air and blah, blah, blah. And so, of course, we needed her to record dialogue. And so Lisa just starts doing this amazing monologue, which was hysterical. And we're like, that's so much funnier than what I wrote. So, of course, that made it in. You know, it was so funny. I read somewhere that they didn't ad-lib a lot, but I think there was quite a bit.
Sometimes writers try and bring drafts to actual teenagers, however they can, to just get like up or down, thumbs up or down vote. Did you do anything like that? Did you try and find some friends that had teenage kids and have them give it a read?
Well, I have teenage friends. So okay. one of my counsel, not like that, gross.
Calm down.
My niece Ellen is this incredibly smart girl. I mean, she's so way smarter than I am, and she reads my stuff, and you know, but she talks like Olive, so she, you know, it wasn't like she said, oh, you know, no one talks like that, because she does. So she was definitely influential and helped me a lot.
It was interesting to see that you were kind of mixing up the genre a little, because it's been so well-traveled over the years that you get the feeling that there's nothing new left to do, but you did a lot new. Like, for instance, there's always the loyal friend. And you axed the loyal friend probably by the end of Act 1.
Oh, that's
putting
so cool.
Your character all alone. When did a decision like that come along?
You know, and that's another. That's one of the biggest changes that happened from page to screen. Rhiannon's character was originally, like, her identifier was not her breasts. Her identifier was actually that she had the worst, like, profane mouth on the planet. Like, she was just, I mean, most of those 47 F words were hers. And so I mean, I thought that was funny. I love it when people cuss. And she, you know, that one definitely had to be toned down for this. And to Ali Machaca's credit, she did such a fantastic job of making that character come to life without, like, that one really funny thing. I mean, she had some of the funnier lines in the script, but they were just, they had to go. And what was the question again?
It was just about her yeah. being abandoned by her friend so early
right,
on.
Right. So I think, you know, fights with friends to me is my favorite thing in the whole world. I mean, teen angst, like, you know, you looked at me funny, so, you know, or you looked at my boyfriend funny, so we're done. I'm never speaking to you again. And then by third period, you're all fine. I love girl fights. I do. I love them.
The love interest in the film, Todd, it was also interesting because it wasn't like he was sought after. There wasn't like a lot of tension. He kind of appeared in and out of the background. So the homage to 16 Candles kind of worked in that sense as well, because you can't say we get to know that guy seen from a distance.
Yeah.
Talk about that. Was there ever more to him, or
no.
Did he have a bigger presence? Because I like the way you integrated that was the first lie she told when right. she faked like they kissed.
He actually had a smaller part in the original script. And, you know, Will in the studio, they were like, you know, let's bring this love thing up to the forefront a little bit. And I wrote the scene in the car. Which is one of my favorite scenes in the whole thing, and you know, he just is this great guy. And I thought what was really fun about it, in most movies, most conventional studio made films, he would have this moment where he condemns her and she tries to get him back and everything, and I liked that she was trying to get him but not get him back. Like, he was on her side. I thought it was really cool, and I love that they allowed that to stay the way it was.
Another staple of the genre is having believable parents. And here you had nice, normal parents that are also out of their frickin' minds with their dialogue. And I loved it. I loved it. What were your challenges in kind of navigating the parental territory?
Well, I mean, I had definitely different images in my mind when I imagined those characters. I mean, you know, and so I wrote them to be just these kooky, weird, fun people. And then Will came and made them incredibly hip, and just, you know, the family dynamic was much more not loving because they were originally loving, but just a tighter bond between them. And then you put those actors in a room together. I mean, you know, it was probably so easy for Emma to, like, you know, I would treat Patricia Clarkson and Stanley Tucci like my parents if they would let me. And of course, they brought this best friend. I mean, I've read that they've been best friends for ages. And you can see it. You can see that they do have this incredible bond between them. And they brought this really, like, ex-hippie eccentricity to it that I thought was just the coolest thing in the world. I mean, to watch them, I will never forget that actually went on for about 20 minutes. And I was laughing so hard. And my parents were on set that day. And they were sitting beside me, and they're looking at each other like, what is going on? And it just kept going, and we're laughing. We're at Video Village laughing so hard, we can't even stand it. And when he said tallywhacker, I thought I was going to die.
You know, it's one thing to do a great comedy and have laughs, but what every great person that writes a comedy really strives for, and the good ones at least, is also having some emotional depth. And in the scene where Brandon explains the real reason why he needs her to kind of alleviate some of the hell that he was going through in high school, it was a nice little emotional moment. Talk about crafting that.
You know, I have to give Dan Bird the credit for that because I think he brought that scene. Well, he brought the character to life, but he brought that scene especially to life. I don't think that I had written it as emotionally impactful as I think he delivered it. So, I mean, I remember when I teared up the first time I saw the movie. I was like, because that character is based on me, and all the friendships that I had with incredible girls over the years. And so, yeah, that was him. That was totally him. I am going to give him all the credit for that.
It was a good scene. You know, something that's always difficult for a first-time writer is navigating studio notes. Now, this sounds like it was a very smooth process.
So easy.
Were there any crazy notes that just kind of made you think twice?
No. It was really not at all. It was so funny. I mean, there were two things. Before Clint ever said, "I like your script" or anything, he said, "There's this one scene that's going." And I was like, okay, which scene? And he said, it was a scene that I had written very early on with Rhiannon's parents in the camping trip. I had originally envisioned Rhiannon's parents totally different. Like, I had him, like, as this very just... They were creepy. They weren't weird. They were creepy. And that's why she didn't want to be in the woods with them. Like, they... And he was like, I think he was just creeped out by it. He was like, this is too bizarre. I'm not, no.
Okay, now you've got to tell us. What were they doing in the woods that was so creepy?
Well, no, it was just the way that I think I described them. It wasn't anything that they said or did. It was just the way that I described them. I was like, he looks like Tiny Tim. And she's wearing practically a wedding dress on a camping trip. And
I want to see that movie, man.
But I still to this day don't know why Clint hated that scene so much. I mean, he hated it. And so he said, that's going. But other than that, we liked the script. That was really the biggest note that I got. And I was like, it's done. Out.
I ask all writers this. I can't even imagine what your answer is going to be because you write so blaringly fast. If you get writer's block, what do you do about it?
Drink.
Really? Seriously?
No. If writer's block, and no, I do get it. I procrastinate a lot, and I check my email. I go on Facebook, and you know, you listening to people on Facebook will eventually inspire some sort of idea. I mean, it's
usually
ridiculous.
Inspires you to close the Facebook window.
Exactly. Yeah. Somebody will say something stupid, and I'll be like, "Oh yeah, now I know what to do."
What was the budget? What was the schedule?
The budget was very small. I don't exactly know what the number was, but it was small. And luckily we got these great actors who...
Do you know what the schedule was?
The schedule, I can't remember. It wasn't long. It was, I want to say a month, a month, maybe. That's what it felt like. A month and a half, maybe.
Your decision to set it in Ojai. I like the location. I love the fact you guys use that bookstore as well.
I know. What's the name of that damn bookstore? I haven't been to the bookstore, but everybody's been talking about the bookstore.
It's the outdoor bookstore, and they leave their books out at night. It's great.
It's so cool. I didn't even realize. Ojai was not my idea. I set it in Anywheresville, USA, and Will loves Ojai, so he said, you know, we're going to set it in Ojai, and I go home. I Google Ojai, O-H-E-Y, and that's O-Hey.
And there's a J in there.
Yeah, there's O-J-A-I. I finally found it. I'm like, ooh, this is pretty.
And so close to L.A.
And so close to L.A., and it was actually so cool to see a teen movie with a textured background, you know, with like levels to it, and not just like flat land and suburbs and houses that all look the same. Because I think that's what I was going for in my mind. And when he sort of presented this as a canvas, I was like, oh, that's amazing. That was a really smart decision.
What did you learn as a writer on your first film during production? Were there ever any times where you needed to rewrite something on set?
Oh, never, never. I mean, Will's a very capable writer, and you know, he had a big hand in the writing of this. And you know, in terms of jokes, I mean, that's what he's so great at. So you know, he would come up with stuff, but he was really cool about it. And you know, he said, you know, if you think of anything, come over to me. But I was like, I'm on a movie set, so I didn't really. I was like a craft service. I was like, this is so cool.
Did they have wine at craft service?
No.
No.
They did in my car.
Good answer, sir. What did you learn during post-production? I mean, because this movie has a lot of voiceover. Voiceover is something that is always shaped and continually shaped during post-production. Were there rewrites? Or?
Up to the last minute. Not by me.
Okay.
Last minute. I mean, we had the premiere last night, and there were things that I hadn't even heard. Yeah, so it was insane. I guess it was up to the last minute.
Was there anything major that was cut out during post-production that you missed, or you were surprised at a reshuffling of scenes being in a different order?
The reshuffling, I think, all sort of worked. There are a couple of scenes I kind of missed that I know got shot, so I'm hoping they'll be on the DVD. There's this great, great scene towards the end. And once we finally knew that it was going to be PG-13, there was, you know, Will called me up and he said, okay, we got one F word. Where is it? And I said, I know which one it is. And so there was the F word scene, which I really hope is on the DVD. But it's in the gym. It's between Rhiannon and Marianne and Nina Howell. And it's a really fun scene, and they did an amazing job with it. So I hope it makes it in.
But they cut it out of the movie, right?
They cut it out of the movie, I think, just for flow. I mean, it was...
They blew your one F word that you get with PG-13?
One F word. Oh, well, you know, the MPAA, I have to say, they were so nice to us, you know, because it's a pretty hard PG-13.
Which is hilarious.
I don't think there's any way to get that F word in.
we recently screened Never Let Me Go, the Fox Searchlight film.
Ooh, I want to see that.
And it got an R rating. And they were talking about how they cannot figure out why. And do you know what I mean? Something as risque as this got away with it. And more power to you. It should. I think they both deserve PG-13. To be honest.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I haven't seen the other one, so
of course,
point of reference. But you know, I think the message here, or not even the message, but just to create a teen sex comedy that has absolutely no sex in it, I think was kind of appealing. Maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's like, yeah.
So they stood behind it. We're going to open it up to the crowd in a minute or two. What was your toughest scene to write? The scene that you kept coming back to, banging your head against the wall, and how did you solve the problem?
Gosh, I think it would have to be that moment where she realizes she needs to set everything right, and I had, you know, scattered all these characters you know, throughout the script, and how she was going to go back to them then and say, and I think now it's in montage. But it was originally a little bit, maybe a little bit more in depth with like going to the specific characters and saying, you have to help me, you have to help me. The other scene that was really tough got cut out as well. The scene where she goes in and confesses to the teacher what's going on with his wife. that was originally a much bigger scene.
And talk about that, because it seemed like she was going to protect him from that, and part of her lying was going to try and, you know, protect him from the horrible truth. And I was a little surprised actually that she does go in and just blurt it out.
Yeah, but I think that's human. I think that's, you know, she was so angry and she didn't know how to channel that anger, and she went and blurted it out and then feels so incredibly bad about it.
So what was your other version? The other version is
an in-depth conversation where they're actually like talking, and she, you know, she has just made this, you know, revelation to him. And actually that was the hardest scene in the whole script to write. Because
the one that got cut out.
Yeah. Because he had to be, and they did a beautiful job acting it. Again, it was just flow thing. I mean, and it was in there for quite some time, and Will was finally, he said, no, I think this scene really has to go. I think we need to stay on Olive and stay on this. But, Will did add that amazing, amazing moment, at the very end in that montage between, Lisa Kudrow and Thomas Hayden Church. I just think I get chills from it.
When they don't speak to each other.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's so good. That wasn't in my draft. So
it was a good moment.
Yeah.
We're gonna take questions from the crowd right there. You, sir. His question was in regards to what's your trick to great characters that fast. And of course, I do want to point out that you did explain that you had a revision period, mm-hmm. or a few revision right. periods as well.
You know, it's not always that fast. It really isn't. I mean, there are sometimes I will struggle up until like the day after my deadline because I haven't found the characters yet. But I think once you find the characters, it's amazing. I mean, they're just talking. I mean, you know, that's the fun part about writing is they're just talking. And if you can get into their heads and just talk, it's really just typing as fast as the conversation happens in your head. Luckily, I'm a pretty good typist, so that helps a lot. I think once you figure the characters out, Olive to me was such this character that I loved from page two. Or page three. I wanted her to have conversations with people. And that's why she's in almost every scene in the entire movie, with the exception of one, which actually that was a pretty weird scene to write. The scene...
I'm trying to think, which one was it?
In the gazebo. With the
Bible group.
Club.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. You sit right there. Great question. I was going to ask it. How involved were you in the casting process, since you were very marginal at your job, as your previous bosses told you, and you had a past career in casting?
You know, it's so funny. I always sound like such a jerk when I say this, or when I tell people, you know, when we start a process or project, you know, I always say, well, you know, I was a casting director, so I can be very helpful in this. And they're like, okay, you go stand in your corner over there, and we'll call you when we need you. And so I, you know, of course I made the plea to be involved in the casting process. I didn't sit in on auditions, but it was a very quick casting process. Mostly offers and favors, really. You know, but they were so great. They sent me lists and they said, you know, what do you think of this list? And when I got the first list, I was like, you guys are on crack. Because, you know, we had Stanley Tucci and Patricia Clarkson and Emma Stone. And when I saw Emma Stone's name, I was like, done and done. This movie is going to be awesome. I love... Did you ever see Drive, the TV show on Fox? It was one of my favorite shows ever. And I used to blog about it. I loved that show. I don't blog. I've never blogged in my entire life, but I was blogging. I was like, and then this car drove by really fast. It was awesome.
Didn't even make it through its first season. That must have devastated you.
But I loved it. I loved it. And I loved Emma from that show. And then I had seen her in Superbad. So when I saw her name on the list, or when Will said, you know, what do you think about Emma Stone? I said, oh, done. Just hire her right now. But you know, and he probably did it just because I said that.
All the way in the middle, you, sir, with the glasses. Question was in regards to music rights, and sometimes writers get attached to certain pieces of music, and there's a few songs of the film that are very integral to the film. It's mentioned in dialogue. It's long-standing jokes like Pocket Full of Sunshine. Were those things from your original script, or were those things that over time you had to change or... afford.
They were not part of my original script. Originally, the sequence, the Pocket Full of Sunshine sequence, where we see Olive's weekend, was set to there's this amazing album, I think it's from the 60s, called Colors by Ken Nordine. And he was a beat poet who took colors and personified them. and did this really amazing like jazz score behind it. And there one was called Olive. And one of the lyrics in it is it basically says that Olive sits around thinking she's drab, but she doesn't understand that she's about to be named Color of the Year. And so that was a big inspiration to me. Like, just that line, like, sort of kept me going with this script. So that one was really hard to lose. But, of course, you've got Pocket Full of Sunshine, which is one of the best scenes in the movie. So Will was totally right on that one, because it wouldn't have been the extraordinary scene that it is had it been, you know, this beat poem from the 60s that no one's ever heard of, except for me. And then Knock on Wood, it was originally Nobody Does It Better, which is one of my favorite songs. I'm a big Carly Simon fan. But it was like a tweaked version with like dirty lyrics. You know, Nobody Does It Better, get it? But I don't even think they tried to get the rights to that, because they were like, we can't afford that, I promise. Just go stand in your corner. And then Will said, you know, we got to find a song. Originally, in the original script, the new mascot was not the woodchucks. It was the meerkats.
How did you arrive on that?
I don't know, but I thought it was funny.
The meerkat.
The meerkat Todd. And he was like, I don't know what a meerkat is. And there are probably some people out there that don't know what a meerkat is. So think of another animal. And so I thought of woodchuck. And then when we were looking for songs, we were like, you know, trying to find something with wood in the title. And Knock on Wood like sprang to mind. And that was like maybe my second meeting with Will when we came up with that. And I think it really works. I love that song. It's fun.
Music was great. Few more questions right there. You were credited for a song. What was it?
Again, it was a situation where they're like, we can't afford Happy Birthday, which is actually really, really expensive.
It is.
And it was the first production meeting, and I drove to Ojai for the first time, and I didn't know where I was going. I was so excited. I'm going to a production meeting, and they're so boring. They are so boring for a writer. Like, nobody cares what you think, so I'm sitting there, I'm like doodling, and Will slips me a note. He said, by the way, we need a Happy Birthday song, and he said, we can use these songs, like, you know, public domain songs. He's like, you know, Yankee Doodle Dandy, and like, you know, he gives me a list. And so during the production meeting, I sat in my corner and wrote the Happy Birthday song, which is what the lobster, because I really wanted to use the Red Lobster happy birthday song, which is hysterical. I don't know if you've ever been to Red Lobster when they do that and they come out with the hats. Again, we couldn't afford Red Lobster, so it's
Lobster
Shack.
Yeah, you changed the title. It was Lobster Shack.
So there's so cheap over there. No, I'm just kidding. They put all the money in the marketing. That was the Happy Birthday song.
You, Ma'am in the Hat. Interesting question. The research screenings are common. Sometimes the editing changes based on how the crowd reacts at a research screening, which sometimes helps a film. Not really always, though. What were your thoughts on it? Were you involved at all? And what changed, if anything, you want to tell us?
From what I was told, the reaction was pretty good early on. So I don't know that a whole lot of changes went in. I'm trying to think back of anything that I heard. It may have actually gotten toned down a little bit, just because there were some offensive things in there. That's the only thing I can think of.
One last question. Right here on the aisle. Great question. You're working in a genre that we all know and love so well. Were there any checkpoints that you had of things that you wanted to subvert, things you wanted to cancel out, and things that you wanted to make sure were in your movie?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there are always things that I want to keep out of a movie. Boring scenes. I definitely... There were no scenes that I wanted to hit or points that I wanted to hit. But you know, I can't even think of anything that, you know, I hate cheesy coincidences. So I definitely didn't want any like coincidences. I don't think there are any in here. Now that I say it, I'm hoping that there aren't any. I hate coincidences. But it which is so odd, because actually my life is full of bizarre coincidences, but I'm the first one to say that would never happen. I don't think that there were necessarily anything. I mean, you know, I think my thought process when I write is so much like a teen comedy, so it was kind of easy. easy for me.
What's next? What are the projects coming up on the horizon, things you're working on now that you want to tell us about?
I'm doing a lot in television. I have a pilot at MTV that we're about to start shooting, which I'm really excited about.
What's it called?
We don't have a name for it.
Could you give us a pitch? Tell us what it's about.
It's based on an Argentine soap opera called Petito Feo. It's a telenovela. It's a lot of fun.
Is that one of the many things you watch on the couch when you're digging around?
They sent that one to me.
Oh, okay.
It's really cute. It's about a girl, a Mexican girl who moves to the States and sort of instantly butts heads with this very nasty girl. It's a similar-ish to Easy A, but it's gonna be explosive. I mean, it turns into it's like a war at a high school. I mean, like literally like a war. And so that I'm really excited about. I just finished the first draft of a remake of a Japanese thriller called 2LDK. Which I'm really excited about also. It's, I don't know if you guys know it, but it's about two girls who live together, and over the course of a night get into a fight, which escalates into violence, which escalates into them trying to kill each other. But it's just two girls in one house. Two girls, one house. I'm pitching that as the title.
Was that kind of new for you to write a thriller? I mean, going on the tale of the comedy stuff that you've done in the past?
You know, this one,
tough?
This one has a, it was so hard. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. And I thought I would be so good at it. I love horror movies. I love thrillers. That's my favorite thing in the whole world to watch. And I thought I was going to be so good at it, and be able to race through it. And that was one that I really had to think.
So was
really
it an assignment that came to you?
It was.
Okay.
But I'm super excited about it. I thought the end results were pretty good. And, it's funny. I mean, it's really, really funny. I mean, it's girl fight.
Is somebody going to be making it? Like, are there plans to go into production on it?
It was an assignment through Relativity.
Okay.
So
great.
Yeah.
Anything else? And that all sounds great.
There's some secret-y TV things that I'm working on that I'm all really. Right. I love television. You guys know. Now you do. Some television stuff, and I'm just looking for the next thing.
Cool. Well, you've been very generous with your time. Give it up again
to
Bert.
Thank you guys so much. I appreciate it.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to screenwriter Bert V. Royal for coming down and spending time chatting with me about his latest film, Easy A.
If you dug this episode of the podcast in general, consider tossing a virtual tip into our PayPal virtual tip jar by visiting www.creativescreenwritingmagazine.blogspot.com and look for the PayPal icon. Your tips are appreciated and definitely help out with equipment, hard drives, and all the other stuff we need to keep this podcast running. Of course, feel free to check out my blog, which I even manage to update on the rare occasion that I have time to do so by visiting www.jeffgoldsmith.blogspot.com. You can also always feel free to drop me a line by emailing me at yo.goldsmith@gmail.com, and I'll do my darndest to get back to you as soon as I can. Of course, don't forget to click that subscribe button in iTunes or your podcatching software, because that's how episodes are downloaded automatically every time you click refresh. And if you have a minute, feel free to leave us positive feedback in the iTunes Music Store or at podcastalley.com. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, Senior Editor for Creative Screenwriting Magazine, thanking you again for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.